something else as well. Go away. All right, so my talk is actually not completely unrelated to the previous one. I'm going to use ideas from effective field theory to look at constraining particular models for new physics. And in particular, I'm going to focus on one particular aspect, which is CP violation. So this is partially review and partially some work, more recent work. And my collaborators, Maxim Pospelov, who's here, Yudi Santoso is also with us in Victoria, and Stefan Huber is our postdoc at CERN. So just to introduce the ideas, what we're thinking about here is precision tests for new physics. So as you all know, the simplest way to go and look for new physics is just to smash things together with as high an energy as you can get and see what comes out. So to do that, if you're looking for new physics at some threshold scale, lambda, you need center of mass energies that are of the same order. However, there's an alternative, which is often a little bit cheaper and sometimes actually a little bit more powerful in the sense of how far you can go, although it is indirect, is to, instead of trying to push the energy scale as far as you can, try and push the precision with which you measure various observables. So in this case, you're looking at things like delta E over E, so this might be precession frequencies of some particles. And what you're looking for here are virtual effects from new physics within the normal physics. So the blue lines here would be standard model particles. And these effects generically scale as some inverse power of this new threshold lambda, where m is a characteristic mass scale in the problem, and n is some coefficient that depends on the process. So this can be extremely useful, particularly when the processes you're looking for violate certain symmetries of the standard model, or perhaps approximate symmetries of the standard model, like CP, for example, which is relatively, it's not an exact symmetry, of course, but in many cases, the effects are very small. This is because the backgrounds are very small. So you're looking just at a signal, and often you can ignore the background. So here's just one example that was mentioned in Graham's talk. If you think about the measurement of, or observation of neutrino oscillations, one of the simplest, at least within this point of view of effective field theory, one of the simplest interpretations is that this comes from the presence of some dimension 5 operator added to the standard model, which, according to symmetries, is actually the only dimension 5 operator you can write down. Everything else starts at dimension 6. And so in some sense, you might think this would be the first place where you would see new physics, just from dimensional grounds. And if you make that interpretation, then this scale, as Gray mentioned, is very large. So 10 to the 13 actually fits right in the middle of this range. So this is a, obviously there's a certain amount of interpretation that has to go into this. This assumes the masses of Majorana, which is something that hopefully will be tested. But if you do that, then you get sensitivity to a very high threshold scale. Okay, so I want to talk about something a little different, which is CP violation within the same context. And one of the things here is that there are various motivations for believing there should be new sources of CP violation. So I guess the most pressing one is baryogenesis. And I'll come back to this a little bit later. It's also true, however, that most models of new physics tend to produce extra CP violating phases, just because as you add extra fields, it's usually just on symmetry grounds very difficult to avoid them. And so it's quite natural to expect we should see something. So for the purpose of this talk, I want to make an assumption, actually, about how this arises. And the assumption will be that new sources of CP violation, so sources that are not related to the CKM phase in the standard model, are irrelevant in the sense that they arise through higher dimensional operators. So this is an assumption. We'll see what it can do. And essentially, I want to look at two particular aspects of this, this assumption. One is whether this kind of picture can actually resolve some of the problems that you might think about in terms of new sources of CP violation. So in particular, can you have a model of baryogenesis in which this works? So here, this is just the standard model. And the other just general question is, what sort of threshold sensitivity do you have? What sort of lambda are you sensitive to with current observations? And so the main probe I'm going to use is electric dipole moments for fundamental particles. So these are interactions like this in non-relativistic form, which couple the spin of some, say, fundamental fermion to background electric field, or if you like, an interaction of a photon with this gamma matrix structure. So first of all, what I want to do before I discuss these questions in a little bit more detail is review a little bit of what we know about these systems and how they can be used to probe for sources of new physics, or sources of new CP violation anyway. So this is the current experimental status. There are, in this case, characterized into three different classes. There's the EDM of the neutron, EDMs of paramagnetic systems, in this case, a thallium atom. And here, because it's a paramagnetic system, it has one free electron, and generically what you're sensitive to is the EDM of that electron. And there are also diamagnetic systems, where all the electrons are paired, and so you're generically sensitive to the EDM of the nucleus, or the nucleons themselves. So there are a couple of numbers here. This one is in red because it's recently been updated. All of these numbers are within the last 5 or 6 years. One thing I'm going to come back to is that you notice the numbers here are extremely small. This is partly because of the choice of units. The important point here that to keep in mind is they're actually quite different. There's a couple of orders of magnitude between them. But for reasons that I'll mention in a moment, it turns out that all three of them are actually more or less competitive in terms of sensitivity to fundamental phases. Just to keep in mind the point I mentioned before about the fact that standard model background is essentially irrelevant here, there is a contribution to the neutron EDM from the CKM phase, but it's many orders of magnitude below current sensitivity. One of the reasons this is an interesting subject at the moment is that there are many new experiments in development. This is just a far from complete list, but in the same categories, paramagnetic systems, the neutron, diamagnetic systems, there are several projects underway. These are primarily sensitive to the EDM of the electron. They use generically polarizable paramagnetic molecules. There are a couple of, actually three different experiments underway to increase the sensitivity to a neutron EDM, diamagnetic systems. There's also a proposal for looking at EDMs of charged particles in storage rings. All of these are actually in development now. It's only the last one, which is still awaiting approval. So I just flashed this list just to give you some idea that experimentally this is quite active at the moment. Okay, so how do we use these observational inputs? So again, standard effective field theory, we just parameterize. In this case, it's useful to parameterize a set of CP odd operators normalized at 1 GeV, ordered in terms of increasing dimension. So the first one you can write down is the famous theta term. It actually incorporates a bare theta parameter and an overall phase of the bulk mass matrix. This guy I'm essentially going to ignore for the purpose of this talk. We have to assume some mechanism for getting rid of it, an axion example. But then there are others, and they start at formally at dimension 5. These are operators with, for example, a quark, a photon field, and formally they're of dimension 5, but you have to bear in mind that there's a chirality flip in all of these operators, and so in principle there's a Higgs-Bev insertion, and so that's why I've actually written them as dimension 6. If you write them above the electroweak scale, they're dimension 6. And then you can have four fermion operators, which by the same token are essentially dimension 8. So all of these guys in principle are important. This is just a complete listing of possible operators that you can write down based on symmetries. So try and remember some of these coefficients that appear. This is the EDM of the quark. This is a corresponding color EDM of the quark, has a tilde on top. EDM of the electron. This is a three gluon operator called the Weinberg operator. And these are these four fermion operators that involve either four quarks or two quarks, two electrons. And they induce interactions, for example, between electrons and nucleons as you go further down an energy scale. So you can draw a picture a little bit like this. So again, energy scale going upwards in this direction. This is some putative fundamental source of CP violation. As you go down an energy scale, these generate these operators that I just listed for you. And then, obviously, these then generate certain observable EDMs. So we have paramagnetic systems, diamagnetic systems, The paramagnetic systems are primarily induced by the EDM of the electron. Diamagnetic systems get contributions from more or less everything. And also, we have the neutron over here. So all the hadronic stuff feeds into both of these. So it's a sort of intermediate level. You can think also of CPR pi and nucleon couplings. OK, so just to give you a brief flavor of some of the computations, and I want to explain the comment I made earlier about the fact that all of those pieces of experimental data are more or less competitive. And the reason comes about from a feature known as the shift theorem in atomic systems, which is essentially that if you apply an electric field to a neutral atom, because it's neutral, you'd better believe that inside the atom, the electric field is shielded somehow. Which is true, but it's a non-relativistic statement, and it's violated by various corrections. And the way it's violated in different systems explains this equilibration of sensitivities. So for paramagnetic systems, you do get sensitivity to the electron EDM, and the violation is through relativistic effects if the electron's in a low orbit near a large nucleus. And in fact, what you find is you get a very large enhancement in certain atoms. So this is, obviously, this is alpha squared, so there's a small parameter here, but there's a z cubed. So if it's a big atom, this number can be quite large. And if you put all the factors in, for thallium, it comes out to be nearly 600. So that's very useful, actually. So you can apply a relatively small field, but your sensitivity in terms of the EDM of the electron is hugely enhanced. So much larger, you're effectively producing a much larger field than you could ever have in the lab. So that's why, even though the experimental bound on the EDM of thallium is a couple of orders of magnitude weaker than for some of the others, it's still very useful because of this enhancement. So there are also other interactions. It's an atomic system, so you can have couplings, quarks, electrons, and so on. For the neutron, it's slightly messier. You have quark EDMs, these quark color EDMs, essentially all of these hadronic contributions. Some of them are a little bit more difficult to compute than others. And for the mercury EDM, which is a diamagnetic system, you get a different violation of this shielding theorem. So now there's no free electron rolling around. The theorem is violated now by the finite size of the nucleus, but this is a very subtle effect. And so instead of a big enhancement, you get a large suppression. It's 10 to the minus 3. So even though the experimental bound is the most stringent on mercury, this suppression sort of equilibrates it with everything else. So I should mention that detailed studies of most of these systems actually were initiated in the 80s by Hriplovich, who's actually in the audience today. So it's an old subject, but it's gained some new life, particularly with recent experimental developments. OK, so that's essentially a review of how some of these things are used. I now want to go on and start talking about possible constraints we can place on models. So the first thing I'm going to discuss, I guess, is the thing that's been studied in greatest detail, which is the constraint on the soft parameters in the MSSM. So as many of you will know, when you break supersymmetry in a generic way, or in a generic soft way, you can add in many terms which are consistent with this soft breaking hypothesis. And most of them are complex because of the fact that supersymmetric systems, so you have chiral fields, and they introduce their own complex phases which violate CP. So in this case, we have mass parameters for Higgs enos. There are various bilinear couplings, trilinear couplings with squarks and Higgses, mass terms for gauge enos, and so on. And generically, these all introduce their own complex phases. What people tend to do is make certain universality assumptions to try and simplify the problem a little bit. And in that way, you can bring yourself down to two physical phases. There are also a couple of U1 symmetries that allow you to rotate some of these things away. But even in that sort of minimal system, you find that generating EDMs is relatively easy. So this would be the EDM of a down quark. So this is a one-loop diagram with a down squark and a gluino, photon coupling here with a squark. Just a simple one-loop diagram. It scales as 1 over m squared in terms of the Suzy mass scale. And generically, if you compute the size of these things and plug them back into those formulae I showed you before, you get into problems because the bounds on these phases, which in principle, by naturalness arguments, would be order one, are not allowed. So here's a kind of caricature of what you can do. So generically, what you find is the bounds on these phases are maybe 10 to the minus 1, 10 to the minus 2, and you don't really understand why this should be. Of course, you can play tricks, and you can try and shift the spectrum around to reduce these bounds. And this is just a sort of picture to illustrate what tends to happen when you do that. You know, how much could you relax them? So, you know, various regions of parameter space here. So you can try decoupling. In that previous diagram, I had down squawks. So partners of the light quarks. You can make those guys heavy. Then you find that there are various, of course, subleading contributions, through loop diagrams, and so on, which don't reintroduce the constraints at quite the same level, but you get a little bit of suppression, maybe a factor of 10. If you want to have baryogenesis in the MSSM, you need one large phase, and so again, you can decouple various other things, but you're still going to have various two-loop diagrams. You can go to other regimes, large tan beta, decouple the fermions, step two doublet model. The most efficient way of doing it is essentially to try and decouple as much as you can, which is essentially all the scalars, so-called split-Suzy limit, but you still have two-loop diagrams, which don't actually give you a strict constraint on the phases now, but it's right at the current sensitivity, so it's order one. So the best you can do is push it to about order one, but no further. But this goes a long way against the sort of naturalness argument for supersymmetry in the first place. So the conclusion, I guess, would be that it's very difficult to come up with a scenario that doesn't get rid of this tuning constraint on the phases unless you push everything into a tuning of the spectrum. So what I want to discuss now is a slightly different interpretation or point of view, which is you could say, well, so suppose someone comes along and gives you a mechanism for supersymmetry breaking which is completely real, doesn't generate any phases in the soft sector at all. What sensitivity would you have to new thresholds? So this is coming back to the point I made right at the beginning. And one way to ask, or one way to try and answer that question, is to parameterize all the operators you could write down at such a threshold. So we're just going to look at dimension 5 here. So we're going to take the MSSM. We're going to assume all those soft parameters are real, so there are no constraints. Of course, in general, you'll have both things together, but we'll just neglect those. And look at these operators. So the nice thing is that dimension 5, there are only a limited set of possible operators you can write down. I mentioned in the standard model there was only one, which was this seesaw operator. In the MSSM, there are a few of them. There's some that give proton decay that we're going to ignore. There's the supersymmetric version of this seesaw operator, which we won't worry about. And then these three, which haven't really been discussed in the literature before, but in principle can be complex and will give you CP violation. One of the nice things here is that if you look at the contribution to EDMs and related operators, they decouple linearly with this threshold scale lambda. So as you improve the sensitivity to these things, you improve the sensitivity to lambda quite dramatically. Now, you have to make some assumptions here about the flavor structure for these couplings. You could assume they're proportional to Yukawa's, which is essentially saying there's no flavor structure. I'm going to do the opposite and assume these things are of order one. So that's a strong assumption that will give us actually much stronger constraints, but bear in mind that this is related to constraints on flavor rather than just CP. So if you've written down those operators, you can write down the sorts of diagrams that they will generate once you integrate out, once you go below the Suzy threshold and integrate out to superpartners. So first of all, you've got corrections to fermion masses. So for example, excuse me, corrections to the electron mass. Corrections to electron mass are generally very large, and that gives you a constraint by saying that the correction shouldn't be larger than the mass itself of about 10 to the 6 GeV. So this is a very strong constraint, but bear in mind this is simply the statement that the electron Yukawa is a very small number. We put it in by hand at the standard model, and that's essentially where this is coming from. Because here, this operator insertion is normalized with a coefficient 1. So that's what everyone in principle would know, or at least would naively expect. What's interesting here, though, is you get much stronger constraints by looking at contributions to are, for example, this EDM of thallium, the mercury EDM, and also other processes that don't violate CP but violate flavor, like mu2e conversion. And the useful operators to look at here are these four fermion operators. They're generated at one loop. You have an insertion here of one of these dimension 5 operators, so there's a 1 over lambda, and then you integrate out the squawks. And these give you sensitivity actually up to scales of order 10 to the 8 GeV, which is very large, and interestingly is not that far away from the sort of scales you might expect for right-handed neutrinos, if you believe that the neutrino mass is Majorana. And so you would have some extra justification for such a scale like that. So that's quite nice that you get this extra sensitivity, and perhaps the crucial thing here is that this is two orders of magnitude above this, which you might think of as a kind of a naturalness bound. So this is just repeating some of those numbers in a bit of a table. These are the particular operators that come in here. But again, you see most of these numbers are of order 10 to the 8 GeV. And it's not too difficult to come up with models that would produce this. I don't want to discuss this in any detail, but all you have to do is expand the Higgs sector in the MSSM. So for example, add a singlet, some extra doublets, and so on. Okay. So the final thing I want to discuss, my remaining 60 seconds, is another application. So now I'm not going to talk about supersymmetry. This is thinking about models for baryogenesis, which use this sort of irrelevant CP violation, so CP violation through irrelevant operators. And just as a little introduction, we know, of course, that the standard model in principle would allow for electroweak baryogenesis. It satisfies all the Sakharov criteria, CP violation, baryon number violation, has phase transition in principle, which could take you out of equilibrium. But there are various problems. The Higgs mass is too large to get a nice first-order transition. And the thing that's relevant for this talk is that there's insufficient CP violation. CKM phase is not going to do the job. So you can get away with this in the MSSM just, although as I mentioned, it's quite difficult with the EDM constraints on the phases. These days, the most popular scenario is leptogenesis, which actually decouples baryogenesis from the electroweak scale completely. And it's fine. The trouble is it's very difficult to test because you've now pushed this threshold scale right up to the scale of right-handed neutrinos. And so EDMs, for example, don't give you any useful constraints. So I want to go back and think again about electroweak baryogenesis. Just think about what's the simplest set of operators you could add which would allow you to resurrect this system. And this has been discussed in a couple of papers recently. So what they found is you can add a dimension 6 operator, which is CP even, correcting the Higgs potential, and turn on another coupling, say, of the Higgs to the top, which gives you an extra CP phase. And it seems to work, more or less, gives you sufficient, gives you the right baryon entropy ratio, provided this threshold scale is not too large, 400 to 800 GeV. So just to be quick, what I want to discuss here is there are various questions you could ask about such a scenario, but what we wanted to look at was whether this was completely consistent in terms of EDM bounds. So with those sorts of operators, the generic diagrams are two-loop diagrams, so-called bar-Z diagrams. Depending on your choice of flavor structure, you get different possibilities. I won't go into too much detail. Just have a look at this plot over here. So here I'm assuming that the two threshold scales, the CP even and the CP odd scale, are the same. And this is contours of eta, so this is actually the preferred experimental value for this baryon to entropy ratio. This is a tenth of it, this is 10 times that. I mean, the experimental number is known very well, but the computation is not so precise, at least the way we were doing it. And these are contours of EDMs, which normalize to their experimental value. So the neutron actually is the strongest. This is mercury and thallium down here. But what you see is there's a region in here which is still experimentally allowed. It's sort of an interesting region because the lower scale here is the Higgs mass. This is the threshold. So it's a sort of interesting region. And it's rather nice because it's pretty easy to see that with the next generation sensitivity, you'll completely cover this interesting region beyond any doubt. So just to conclude, summarize quickly, I talked about two particular scenarios for this relevant source of CP violation: constraining thresholds in supersymmetric models, which again are quite powerful, push you up to the scale of right-handed neutrinos, or will do so with the next generation experiments. And also you can do similar things with very minimal models of baryogenesis, electroweak baryogenesis, which again will be conclusively tested with next generation experiments. Okay, thanks.